On this episode of The Big Number, we react to the NBA Cup Final game between the Knicks and the Spurs and give you the latest with the NBA injury crisis across the league. Coming up right now. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to The Big Number. It is a special NBA Cup Final recap edition of The Big Number on this Wednesday morning. Dan, how are you, man?
I'm doing great. I'm coming to you from Brooklyn, New York City, and the energy in the air has just been, like, it's been remarkable this morning. A little bit more smiles as you walk to school, a little bit more pep in everybody's step. And I think the reason why, Tom, is because the New York Knicks are NBA Cup champions this morning. What an incredible turn of events. The first non-summer league championship in 52 years. And yeah, it's not like maybe a championship, but it's still pretty good. And it makes me wonder, Tom, as we are recapping the day, what is the big number coming out of the NBA Cup final?
Yeah, everyone's walking a little funny today because they got more money in their pockets in New York City because this week's big number is $530,933.
That is so many dollars.
So many of them. $500,000 is going to every player on the winning team, which is the New York Knickerbockers. And that, my friends, is the most that we've seen in this long storied history of the NBA Cup. They're getting $530,000 each. That's everybody on the roster. The full-time roster is getting that much money, which is a big reason why these players are caring about it. Dan, I'm going to steal a little line from one Kawhi Leonard on Board Man Gets Paid here, because they're getting all that cash because of that offensive rebounding that they did. They smashed the boards in the fourth quarter, led by Mitchell Robinson over Victor Wembanyama and the Spurs. And the way they won this game is emblematic of the way a lot of teams are winning games now. It's 32 second chance points by the New York Knicks, which is the most since February 29th. 2020, most second chance points by a New York Knicks team in regulation since five plus years ago, pre-COVID. So it's been a long time. Bobby Portis was on that team, Dan, and we're seeing a lot of teams winning with this formula. Fred Katz, who does a great job out of New York, covering the New York Knicks for a while, but now writing nationally for The Athletic, did a big takeout story about the rise of the offensive rebounding machine across the NBA. And the Knicks are kind of the poster child for this. Is that Mike Brown is a big believer in getting offensive rebounds. And the way you saw it in this game was Mitchell Robinson getting a lot of boards, 10 of them, and kicking out to dagger threes. Tiago Splitter for the Portland Trailblazers, the Blazers call them literally dagger threes. When you get an offensive rebound, kick out to a three-point shooter, and you make those dagger threes, they are engineering their entire offense to make sure that they can maximize that. And the Blazers take more offensive rebound threes than any team in the NBA, but they don't make the most. You know who makes the most?
I got to guess.
So they do a lot of that, and they did a lot of it against the Spurs and in winning fashion. So Dan, what are your thoughts after you watched this game? Again, the Knicks winning the cup against the Spurs, and Jalen Brunson, OG Anunoby, they were all awesome, but a lot of it was Mitchell Robinson and Tyler Kolek doing a lot of the little things around the basket.
Yeah, 124-113 Knicks win over the Spurs, and Mitchell Robinson in a relatively short, I think 18 minutes, he completely, completely like changed the game. The driving factor there, I know we've talked about this a lot. I think he was plus nine in 18 minutes in an 11-point win. And it felt like it. It felt even more than that, actually. You know, I wrote about this in the sort of our game preview at Yahoo Sports, but the possession battle is really where the Knicks have their kind of secret superpower on the offensive end of the court. Yes, Jalen Brunson's fantastic. Yes, Karl Anthony Towns is a great shooter. They've got talent on the offensive side of the ball. They get more bites at the apple than the opponent to a greater degree than pretty much any other team in the league. Our guy Jared Dubin over at his site Last Night in Basketball tracks the possession battle You know, are you getting more offensive rebounds than you give up? Are you getting to the line more often than you're sending the other team there? Are you avoiding turnovers more than the other team? And the Knicks are number one in there. They're averaging about 5.5 more possessions per game than their opponent over the course of the season. That's tops in the league. And you saw the impact of that when you're seeing, yeah, I mean, in the fourth quarter, especially, I believe it was 12 more field goal attempts by the Knicks in that decisive fourth quarter. And the Spurs could not get a defensive rebound to save their life, even when they had either Luke Kornet or Victor Wembanyama on the floor. Mitchell Robinson was extending possessions, as you mentioned, those second chance opportunities that lead to threes, which is something that extended beyond, it predates Mike Brown. That was a Tom Thibodeau thing as well. Isaiah Hartenstein, I remember that, the huge playoff win against the 76ers, where the Knicks get that, the second chance point, the second chance, a Hartenstein rebound kicks out to Dante DiVincenzo for the three, right? Like this, that concept. So many bangs. But this is that's that concept of like, we have the best way for us to tilt the math. Yes, we have shooters, we've got talent, but it's also if we get more shots on goal than you do, we're going to have a great chance to be able to win the game. And it's going to be a way for us to, if we do have an off shooting night, but we get more shot volume than you, we're going to still have a really good chance to put up the numbers that would get us to that winning spot. And so Mitchell Robinson is a massive part of that. 10 offensive rebounds in 18 minutes, 15 rebounds total, two assists because two of those offensive rebounds led to him passing out two threes. Jordan Clarkson, you know, the beneficiary of that. OG Anunoby, the beneficiary of some of that. Mitchell Robinson, you know, obviously you mentioned the NBA Cup final numbers don't count. Those stats just sort of disappear into the ether. Mitchell Robinson is rebounding 28% of the Knicks' misses when he's on the floor this season. No player that's like been a qualifying number of minutes player has ever gotten more than 22% of his team's offensive rebounds in a season. And Mitchell Robinson is flirting with 30. It's just, he's such a difference
one
maker.
Out of every
in
three.
Such a,
think about that. One out of every three misses is in Mitchell Robinson's hands. That's absurd. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're at a place where because he barely ever touches, looks at the rim with the ball, you try to throw him a lob pass or a bounce pass in the lane and it's almost guaranteed to be a turnover. He gets the offensive rebounds, but very rarely puts it back in. He feels a little, and he can't shoot from beyond arm's length of the rim. He feels like an anomaly in today's NBA a little bit. Like if you don't have a center that has that kind of skill, he also generally isn't racking up huge block numbers. It's like, well, what does he do? And this is it. He's like an engine for just more offensive chances. And it's why he's been a huge impact player for the Knicks in the playoffs. That series against Cleveland a couple of years ago, through the run last year, the Celtics had no idea what to do with him outside of trying to hack him and get him off the floor. Goes into the starting lineup against the Pacers, makes a big impact there. In these kind of games, offensive rebounding is so critical. The more possession count you can get is so huge. He makes a gigantic impact for them. You see it there against Wembanyama and the Spurs. Tons of heroes abound. You mentioned Tyler Kolek, Jordan Clarkson. These are guys that, you know, Jordan Clarkson maybe would have gotten a look under Tom Thibodeau. I'm not so sure that we know for a fact that Tyler Kolek didn't get off the bench for all, but I think like 7 minutes last postseason. Mike Brown gives him an opportunity to start the season. You know, Brunson goes out, he gets more minutes. Deuce McBride's been out, he gets more minutes. And that runway, that confidence, I think you see guys know that they're going to get chances, they're going to get opportunities, and when they get them, they're going to get their number called. They have the confidence to sort of step in and deliver huge plays, you know, complimentary ball handling to kind of take the pressure off Brunson with all the ball pressure the Spurs were putting on him, picking him up in the backcourt. You need somebody else to run offense. Kolek was huge in that regard. Jordan Clarkson, you expect him to take shots, maybe make some of them, but take a lot of them. He had like a come from behind block. He picked off a lob pass. He got two offensive rebounds in that fourth quarter run. Like he was making impact plays even without shooting, but also somebody that you can have as another target on those offensive rebound, kick out, dagger threes. And so like this to me felt like this is the object lesson. This is the case study in why the Knicks moved from Tom Thibodeau to Mike Brown. The idea of we're going to give more guys more opportunities. We're going to be a little more flexible and creative. Given how Tom Thibodeau's his feelings about playing smaller across the perimeter, I don't know that we would have ever seen a Jalen Brunson Tyler Kolek, Jordan Clarkson lineup in the first quarter of a game that didn't matter, let alone the fourth quarter of a, you know, championship game. And Mike Brown went with it. He went with it even though he had Mikal Bridges and Josh Hart on the bench. Those guys never were on the bench under Tom Thibodeau. Never. And, you know, but this lineup was working. The math they had with OG Anunoby, who was sensational in his own right on both ends of the floor, and Mitchell Robinson, like, they had something that was working, and Mike Brown was confident enough in those guys to let it roll. That flexibility, that understanding of if we play a little bit differently, we can get a lot more out of a lot more guys. That was really on display throughout the cup run and then significantly in that fourth quarter of the final, where the Knicks were taking body blows all throughout that game. They were down, I think, 12 in the third quarter. They stuck with it. They stayed afloat. And then being different got them to a place where they were able to pull out this win. So if you are a Knicks fan this morning, if you are a cup respecter, you are looking at this and saying, that's why all that needed to happen. Whether it sustains in the playoffs, whether it sustains the whole rest of the way, I don't know. But this was a team that was right on the cusp and needed something else to get it over the hump. And I think this is the argument for there's a little bit more here than we were getting. There was more on the plate that we weren't actually able to eat last year. Mike Brown is going to give us the opportunity to get every morsel of it. And you're seeing it there. And, you know, winds up in a big win over the Spurs in a contested game.
I respect the cup, Dan. Do you respect the cup? Because news coming in just as we're recording here that the Knicks are not respecting the cup, at least in this sense, from Stephon Bondi, our guy over the New York Post. Breaking news reporting that the Knicks have decided against hanging an NBA cup banner. The Post has learned there will be a, quote, appropriate celebration before the next home game Friday. The team is said to be focused on the bigger picture. They'll be the first cup champion to not hang a banner. Of course, the Bucks and the Lakers have banners. Bernard King, right? They got to save some room for... Oh, he's not on there. Oh, wait. Carmelo Anthony. He's not there. Okay. So, wait, what? Why? Wait, Eastern Conference champions. Okay. Atlantic Division. Wow. So they're willing to have Atlantic Division champions over the NBA Cup championship, which is won in a competition amongst 30 teams. They'd rather have that Atlantic Division champion banner instead of the NBA Cup. Can I just say, Dan, that speaking of second chances, I hope James Dolan gets a second chance here to recant this decision, because this is for the better of the league that they take this with great importance and value the NBA Cup and put it on a pedestal, hang the banner, and Giannis Antetokounmpo last year not celebrating in the locker room because they got bigger things and bigger fish to fry later on down the season. Adam Silver has to get these people to stay in line. Like, I don't understand what the deal is. The NBA Cup was awesome. It was great. It's also making people a lot more money. The title sponsorship is the Emirates Airlines. These players are getting $500,000 each, okay? It was a great TV production. And here we have the morning after. The signal to Knicks fans right now is actually don't get excited about this. Don't get excited. Which is the exact opposite message you should be sending to your fans. And I'm just like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, I think the way for Adam Silver to get James Dolan to celebrate this would be to tell James Dolan not to do it. To Adam Silver needs to have some reverse psychology here, because I think what we've learned from a number of reports over the years is James Dolan has kind of a wild hair for the front office and for the NBA office and the way that they operate certain things. And he's a sort of perpetually in opposition to what Adam Silver and the league are trying to do. And maybe some aspects of that he's got a point. Many of them, maybe he does not. But that I would not be surprised if this was a little bit of just like thumbing the nose at the league, because that seems to be, you know, James Dolan's kind of raison d'etre, you know, if we can be a little French about it. And I get that would be why that would happen. I do think there is an aspect of the Knicks brand and ownership and whatever that is like we're a little bit above certain things. And I would respectfully submit, I would respectfully submit that the Knicks are not above anything. As someone who's watched the Knicks for most of the last quarter century, there's no argument that you should be above this. The Madison Square Garden, as someone who goes and covers games at the Garden and goes up to the Chase Bridge up there and is sort of up, in the high vantage point, you know, there's banners up there celebrating, you know, the sold out concert streaks of people like Billy Joel, Harry Styles, and Phish. It doesn't seem to me like you can't make some space for a banner celebrating a championship that the team that plays there won. If you want to do it, I believe the Lakers a couple of years ago, it was like a different size and a different shape. And it was clearly demarcated as like, this is different than all of our many championship banners. That seems to me eminently reasonable to say, yeah, we don't have to make it like we're going to have it's ring night, but you could say this is a cool thing that happened. And I think all of these things have the seriousness and value that you imbue them with. It's not like these were handed down on tablets from on high that we celebrate only at a certain point of a certain thing. Like, if you care about it, if we treat it like it matters, it'll matter. And if we don't, then it won't. I think a lot of people just watching generally are like, this is cool. The games are further spread apart. They're playing harder. They're healthier. The product on the court is pretty good when you actually get to these sort of single elimination, the knockout stages of it. It works in this way. So treating it like it's kind of like a left-handed little, little sibling that we just sort of toss off to the side, I feel like it defeats the purpose. What is Knicks ownership if not committed to defeating the purpose? It should not take away from what we actually saw on the floor, which I do think was worth celebrating.
Yeah. I think that was a big miss. And I think it does your fans a disservice by diminishing the power of what they just did against all 30 teams. They got to the knockout rounds and they beat a team that just beat a two loss team or a one loss team before the Spurs got to them. I think it's something that the NBA has to figure out is how to get these teams in line about the messaging and the importance of the NBA Cup and what this can be. Cause clearly James Dolan and Giannis and whomever just don't respect the cup, but I respect the cup. I think it's great. big fan of it. And what I'm not a fan of is that I can't look up this game on Basketball Reference. This is the place to nerd out on the Big Number Pod. And the fact that I can't look up the stats from this game on the best database site in sports at Basketball Reference, because this is not an official game in the regular season that counts to the standings and the stats for the players, I can understand that Basketball Reference and other sites can't really put this on their sites in their database. But it's just that really annoyed me this morning. I don't know about you, Dan, waking up and being like, oh, I want to compare the Knicks 3-point shooting off of offensive rebounds compared to their game log this season. Can't do it. Not on Basketball Reference, not on pbpstats.com, two of our hubs of this wheel that we do on this show. And it feels like we need to fix that too. So two rants. One is put up the banner, respect the cup, and two, respect Basketball Reference and the other stats databases that make this show run. So there we go. Dan, if you don't respect the cup, maybe you respect the trophy. And I feel like we need to have a real serious discussion again about how the Knicks, after winning the cup, we need to take them seriously as title winners. And so we're going to go to three little numbers here after the break with you, Dan, kicking off your three little numbers about the New York Knicks possibly becoming the first team to win the cup and the championship right after this. All right. Today's big number is $530,000+ that the Knicks players each got a nice check for winning the NBA Cup. They respect that. I know that, Dan. Do you respect them as NBA title champion contenders? Well, we got a few numbers here to talk about that. Let's dive in with your first little number of the day, Dan.
Yeah. Before we get into it, I just want to say, this is not to suggest that the Detroit Pistons do not also deserve respect in this conversation. I am aware that the Pistons are 21-5 and in the lead in the Eastern Conference right now. Coming off the final, we're talking about the Knicks, who have had the highest net rating of any Eastern team and are coming off a championship. So Detroit Pistons, you are respected as well, and we will talk about you another time. Today we are talking about the New York Knicks. Our first little number is 21.5 plus 21.5, that is. That is the Knicks' net rating when the starting lineup of Jalen Brunson, Karl-Anthony Towns, OG Anunoby, Mikal Bridges, and Josh Hart is on the floor. With that five-man unit in the game, New York has outscored its opponents by 37 points in 77 minutes so far during this regular season. That works out to 21.5 points per 100 possessions, which is the best mark of any five-man lineup in the league to play at least 75 minutes together. The Knicks are now 4-0 in games at that fivesome starts and 10-1 since reinserting Josh Hart into the starting lineup. That includes the cup final, which, as we just mentioned, that those stats don't matter, but they matter to me right now. So we're saying that 4-0 with that lineup, 10-1 since Hart went back into the starting five. Last season, that group, which, as you might remember, Tom Thibodeau leaned on more often than any coach leaned on any lineup in the league, was only plus 3.3 per 100 across more than 900 minutes in the regular season. And it was actually a net negative after January 1st. That's when, like, teams started putting a center onto Hart and wings onto Cat, and everything got all messed up with that lineup. So if you are looking for support for the idea that this year's Knicks can make a even deeper run, can get themselves to further into the conference finals, to the finals, have a chance to actually pull the double here with the cup and the NBA championship, I think it probably starts with the possibility that that lineup, all those guys, they paid all that money, they traded all those picks, et cetera, that lineup is as good as they hoped it would be.
Well, I think less is more in this sense is that you don't have to play them 48 minutes to get the most out of them. I think it actually cutting back on their minutes is actually the reason why you're going to see the bench lineups succeeding. Like Tyler Kolek, he had the first time in his career, last 2 years, he had never played a clutch minute for the New York Knicks. And then he did that in the NBA Cup final, which I think is a testament to, Mike Brown realizing that if we're going to win an NBA championship, if we're going to get all the way to the end, he was on the same bench as the Steve Kerr Warriors, where they were very, very, very encouraged to lower the minutes of their best players to lift up their bench units and then get more out of their starting lineup when it matters in the postseason, so they're not run into the ground. So I'm surprised that that number that you gave me, the 77 minutes is all that they've had playing together, but it makes sense in the whole Mike Brown idea of like, we're going to get improve our bench and we're going to look at some different lineups because we know what we have with those five guys, but we're going to actually have a higher ceiling with those five guys and a higher ceiling with the bench. So I'm for one, am all for this lineup having a much higher net rating with lower minutes, simply because Tom Thibodeau did all the work last year in establishing the chemistry and it ran them into the ground. And as you saw, they were not good in the second half of the year as a unit. And I think a lot of that had to do it was too much. So less is more.
Which is an interesting segue, you're a really good host, to our second little number this week, which is 7.9. That's how many minutes per game on average Jalen Brunson has possession of the ball for the Knicks this season. So that 7.9 number sounds like a lot. It's because it is. It's tied with Cade Cunningham for the second highest time of possession in the NBA this season, behind only Luka Doncic. But it is also notably down about 8% from last season when Brunson had the rock for 8.6 minutes per game, which was the league leading number. So it's something you mentioned last episode, Tom. We were talking about we were setting up the knockout rounds, and we said Brunson's dribbles per game had dropped precipitously from last year to this year. Something Stan Van Gundy mentioned during the quarterfinal matchup against the Magic on Prime Video's broadcast, where his seconds per touch had dropped. He's still obviously the focal point of the offense, but he's getting off the ball earlier and more often. And as you mentioned, that's that less is more idea. It gives more other guys a chance to get a touch, get in the flow, develop some rhythm, put themselves in position to attack or make a play for someone else. And so they're not just like coming in cold whenever someone needs a bailout shot, right? I think it's why you see guys like OG Anunoby, who, again, game high 28 points in the cup final, and Mikal Bridges off to such strong starts to the season. Why guys like, when they're healthy, Deuce McBride and Landry Shamet have been off to great starts, and why guys like last night, Kolek and Jordan Clarkson, if they feel more involved, more empowered, like they're not just sort of, it's coming out cold and being thrown into the mix. It also gives Brunson more of an opportunity to attack an already shifted defense. If somebody else is running an action to bend the defense and draw coverage, he's getting the chance to attack a closeout, right? Blow past a guy who's like a little bit late getting to him, or play off the catch and maybe take a catch and shoot three as opposed to having to create one off a seven dribble combination. And like the result of this has been arguably the best offensive start of Brunson's career. He's seventh in the NBA in offensive estimated plus minus over at Dunks and Threes. Only guys ahead of him are Jokic, SGA, Giannis, Steph, Luka, and Donovan Mitchell. And the Knicks have jumped up to second in offensive efficiency behind the Denver Nuggets. So yeah, less is more, even when Brunson's still doing a lot. But a little bit less has been a lot more for this entire Knicks offense.
If you remember the NBA Finals, kind of when it turned was when Jalen Williams was taking more of the initiative as a playmaker. And I feel like Mike Brown might have taken some notes there, is that like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander can't do everything for this offense. And oftentimes getting the ball to your secondary ball handler and empowering them to lead the offense can really unlock a lot of things and take a lot of the weight off of the shoulders of your number one guy. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander last year, by the way, 10th in ball possession last season, was not a guy that was throwing a complete game every time he had the ball on the mound, whereas Jalen Brunson led the league in that category. So I think it much needed is that you need to empower other people around him. And I think he's going to look, these guys are incredibly competitive. You're not going to hear Jalen Brunson say, I would like to not have the ball in my hands as much. Right. You're not going to hear him beg and plead to the coach, especially last year with Tom Thibodeau, being like, I don't think I can shoulder the load for you, coach. It's not something they're going to say. So sometimes as a coach, you have to know what's best for them, save themselves from themselves. And so I think that's what you're doing with Jalen Brunson by being like, hey, let's make sure you're not having too much on your shoulders, because we got other guys on this roster who can do a lot of great things, and we're going to need to lean on them in big moments in the postseason. And that's ultimately what you want to, you know, prioritize, is making sure that not just in the NBA Cup, which is banner worthy, is you want to hang up an actual NBA championship banner. So yeah, I think less is more in that instance too.
I think the recipe for them is to be able to pair that elite offense with a, you know, better than good enough defense. And that brings us to our third and final little number this week. 11th. That is where the Knicks rank in defensive efficiency, according to both NBA Advanced Stats and Cleaning the Glass. Cleaning the Glass, they strip out garbage time from their possession numbers. NBA.com does not. Dunks and Threes has an adjusted defensive rating stat that factors in the quality of the defenses, or the offenses rather, that you have played. In their metric, the Knicks are a little bit lower. They're 14th, so like a tick above average, but also about like a tick below that 11-12 range. And that's above, or again, above average, just on the fringes of the top 10. Not elite at any one thing, this Knicks defense, but pretty good at a bunch of them. Around the top 10 in defensive rebounding rate, opponent turnover rate, avoiding sending opponents to the foul line, opponent field goal percentage at the rim, limiting transition opportunities. So they're doing that offensive rebounding, but they're also getting back, balancing the floor, which I know was something that Fred noted in that piece that he wrote at The Athletic about how offensive rebounding has evolved. The Knicks can, we saw some of their downfalls on the defensive end in the Cup Final against San Antonio, where they're allowing dribble penetration at the point of attack. They're giving up a lot of threes. But generally, they're in that same like fringes of the top 10 ballpark that they were in under Tom Thibodeau. And if that holds, and you combine that with the leap from like a 7th or 8th ranked offense to a 1st or 2nd ranked offense, I mean, that's basically the Nuggets formula, right? That is how the Nuggets won the championship a couple of years ago, how they pushed OKC to 7 last year, and how their theory of who they are this year puts them in that case. We have the best offense in the NBA, and we've got an above average defense. Whether the Knicks, I mean, obviously the Knicks don't have a Jokic. They're doing it in, you know, in the aggregate. But that's the math on how they get to where they want to go. And we're a long way from there, but so far, looking so good.
Yeah, man, OG, we should get some shine to that guy, right? OG, I know.
Yes.
So good, especially from the start, the way he led that offense. But defensively, it's just so nice to have that guy on your team. How many teams would love to have OG Anunoby right now? You know, just the ability to play big, play small, shoot. Super skilled player and tough as nails. And so in that game, you want OG Anunoby on your side. Really interesting that Mike Brown didn't have Mikal Bridges, who was first team all defense a few years ago, second in defensive player of the year, and didn't play him down the stretch in this game because he trusted Tyler Kolek and, of course, Jordan Clarkson to make big plays, and they did. So part of this is Tom Thibodeau ran Mikal Bridges down to the bone, where he even was like uncle, like crying uncle at the end of the season, was like, I feel like other guys can play more minutes. We don't need to play 40 minutes a night. And sure enough, we see the Knicks looking a lot fresher down the stretch against the San Antonio Spurs team that looked tired and young in that fourth quarter. And that's the idea if you're the New York Knicks, is that you want to outplay, outlast your opponents, especially on the defensive end with OG Anunoby is just so good. You know, this is a Knicks team that, yeah, they have a long way to go, but their net rating, their defensive ranks, way better than last year. And I do think that this Knicks team feels like, to me, the favorite out east to make it to the NBA Finals. But it's before Christmas. We're still a week away from Christmas. A lot can happen between now and then. But making sure that they got extra battery power come playoff time is, I think, goal number one.
Yeah. One last note on that, as you mentioned, you know, their net rating and you know, where they are in these improvements. There's a sort of a yin and a yang here. It is worth noting that when you just factor in games against opponents with top 10 net ratings, so like, you know, best teams in the league, Knicks are 5-3, and they have the best net rating against those teams, according to Cleaning the Glass. So that's one side of it that gives you feel, you know, make you feel really confident about the Knicks' chances against these other elite opponents. It is also worth noting they have yet to play the Thunder, Nuggets, Rockets, Pistons, or Lakers. All of those games are loaded into the back half of their schedule. And so they're going to have some hellacious scheduling to deal with in January and February. Actually, a real tough run for them starts right away. They go on like a Thursday, Friday back-to-back after winning the Cup Final. So we'll see how they look the end of this week. But the Knicks have the toughest tests for them lie ahead, but they have done really, really well against the ones they faced so far.
Yeah. One thing that was an injury scare last on Tuesday night was Karl Anthony Towns grimacing in pain, grabbing at his knee, and he's been dealing with a calf strain. So I'm not really clear what his status is going forward, but he gutted it out down the stretch in the NBA Cup Championship. But it is something that we're keeping an eye on, is that calf strain for Karl Anthony Towns and Victor Wembanyama, who came off the bench in this game for its second straight time in the NBA Cup tournament. That is notable because there is a crisis in the league right now. The two scariest words in the NBA, calf strain. It's something I wrote about last week for Yahoo Sports. And Dan, we're going to talk about that topic, which Adam Silver hit on in the press conference before the NBA Cup Championship final game took place in Vegas. So after the break, we're going to talk about that. All right, Dan, these names, what do they have in common? Giannis Antetokounmpo, Evan Mobley, Drew Holiday, Austin Reeves, Ty Jerome, Ben Shepherd, Larry Nance Jr., and Pat Connaughton. You can throw in Anthony Davis in there, who's dealing with a calf injury at the moment. 9 players out with calf injuries. That's more players out with calf injuries when I looked at this yesterday than ankle injuries in the NBA, and more people dealing with calf stuff than foot stuff in the NBA, foot injuries. Oof. This is kind of unheard of in the NBA that we would see ankles and foot injuries being less common than a calf injury. So I wrote about this last week, Dan. Two scariest words in the NBA is calf strain, because calf strains are up 40% year over year through 20 games, according to Jeff Stotts of InStreetClothes.com. But the scarier number is that the time lost due to those injuries is up by 200%. So we've seen 18 calf strains last season through 20 games, and they those 18 calf strains led to 36 games lost due to injury. This year, 25. It goes from 18 to 25 calf strains through 20 games of this season, and then not 36 games lost, but 108 games lost due to injury as a result of those calf strains. So this is a very different environment right now, what we're dealing with in the NBA, both from, I think, a medical side. Is, I think, after what happened to Tyrese Haliburton in the NBA Finals, where he returned from a calf strain in game 5, gutted out game 6, and then in the opening minutes of game 7 and against OKC, it was awesome, right, Dan? Awesome to see. didn't seem like the calf was bothering him at all with those three-pointers against OKC. And then he goes down pushing off that calf, that heel, and having his Achilles rupture. I think a lot of teams are looking at this situation and saying, we don't want that to happen, right? And the really interesting thing is I listed all those names. Victor Wembanyama is back. Ja Morant is back-ish from his calf strain, dealing with, I think, an ankle issue now. I think teams are terrified to see another Achilles tear, but what is really interesting in the data is that Jeff Stotts reporting to me that he has over 400 instances of a calf strain in his database that goes over past over a decade. Only two of them have resulted in an Achilles tear. And that's 2019 Kevin Durant in the NBA Finals for the Warriors and Tyrese Haliburton this past year in the NBA Finals. So as someone who's been covering the league for quite a while, Dan, and unfortunately having to write about injuries and what they mean for everyone's favorite teams, is this something that you felt too, that calf strains seem to be coming up more and that this story you feel like is one of the top stories in the league?
Yeah. Well, first off, if people who are listening to this have not read Tom's story on calf strains and the incidence of them, it is phenomenal work. It's super in-depth. You know, he can't say it because it's his stuff. I'm telling you, it's phenomenal.
Your check for $530,000 in the mail, by the way. Thank you.
Sweet. Yeah. I'm going to buy myself a little ugly Christmas sweater with that money. It is surprising to me to hear that the only two that are like directly, the only two Achilles tears directly preceded by calf strains were KD and Haliburton. It also does not surprise me at all to hear that the impact of those and the fact that they were in the NBA Finals, everybody is watching them, that might have like an outsized psychological impact on fans, on decision makers, on, you know, the league writ large, because the downside of that, and I guess like you could, Damian Lillard didn't have a calf strain, he'd had the blood clot, right? And but there was like an antecedent that you could say, well, he had this lower leg issue, came back from it, you know, I think the reporting around at the time was like a sort of like historically quick return, and then goes down. Yeah. Tatum had not had that same sort of like precursor injury, but similar sort of thing, going for a loose ball again in that playoff game against the Knicks, pushes off and that's it. And so I think the idea of, we saw several Achilles ruptures in quick succession. A couple of them did have some kind of lower leg antecedent, makes you feel like you need to be 200% sure that you are not going to run an increased risk or a dramatically elevated risk of that before clearing a guy to come back. Like if you are in this case, we'll use Victor Wembanyama because he played in that cup final and he's at, you know, a minutes restriction coming off the bench. You know, obviously not the preferred deployment of one of the most electric performers in the league and the real difference making bellwether for the Spurs. But if you are a Spurs decision maker, you think, I can live with a few more games of him not playing and a few games of him playing limited minutes while we make damn sure. I cannot live with the potential decade-long ramifications of what if we're wrong about this. And so, yeah, it's been a wildly unfortunate story to hover over the opening part of what's been, for me, a really entertaining start to this NBA season. I think a lot of fans feel the same thing. I think when you hear Adam Silver at his press conference say, like, we are at a place where the crisis point here is getting stars on the floor. We are trying to solve that problem. This is where the rubber is going to keep meeting the road. If you've got these guys who are the major bell cows for their organizations, the ones who on whom the fortunes of the teams and the league rise and fall, you can't just push them through the severity of injury, and teams are going to do everything they can to protect that investment. And the league and maybe some of the viewers will sometimes suffer as a result of that. But I mean, a hell of a lot of people, a hell of a lot smarter than me, are trying to solve this problem. And I don't know that they've got any answers either, beyond the one that, as we have talked about so many times, if you had fewer games and they were more spread out, you would have a better chance of reducing these sorts of strains and lower extremity injuries. And nobody seems to be particularly excited about actually moving toward that idea. So here we are.
Yeah, I talked to two sports docs, prominent sports docs for the story. Dr. Richard Ferkel, the one who operated on Klay Thompson's Achilles tear and also on Steph Curry's ankles. DeMarcus Cousins, Rodney Hood. There's a bunch of guys that he's repaired Achilles tears for. I asked him just, you know, what are his thoughts on what's driving this rise in Achilles tear? There were a record seven Achilles tears last year, and calf strains are up like the data suggests. He's seeing that too, that calf strains are way up this season. And he's on a committee with the NBA to try to solve this problem. And so he is working with the league on try to figure out some sort of relief on this front. And he, when I asked him, do you think the density of the schedule, the number of games that they have to play and all the travel, do you think there is a relationship there? And he said, I believe so. But I would like to see all of the science, all of the data on it. But I believe there is a relationship to all of the back-to-backs, the density of games in the NBA schedule. And the fact of the matter is, are these players missing this much time because teams are like, we need this to recover properly. And unfortunately, we do have a game on Tuesday and Wednesday and Friday, and people are yelling at us like, we need to play more games. You need to play your stars more. And there is kind of a balance here. A conundrum for a lot of these athletic trainers and medical staffs is, on one side, the NBA is instituting this player participation policy that is very much encouraging teams to give the green light, medically sound green light, to play their stars more. But at the same time, they're going up against a schedule that has been very difficult. And you saw in the NBA playoffs, Aaron Gordon, we had a hamstring strain, and Steph Curry in that series coming out of that Houston Rockets series with the hamstring strain being like, yeah, too quick of a turnaround for us to play at this level, the speed, the intensity of the game today and the geometry of the sport. Yes, it's still 82 games and 48 minutes. But within those 48 minutes and within those 82 games is a lot more mileage on the tires than previous generations. So I feel like the NBA is seeing a reckoning right now with its biggest stars going out with calf strains and Achilles tears. And I hope it stops here. I hope the reckoning stops here, because star players are missing one out of every three games now. And it used to be one out of five, one out of six games. And so this is accelerating at a point that I think is very dangerous for the league. And it might not hurt in the short run. You know, teams are still selling out arenas, and they, by the way, signed a record TV deal with Amazon and NBC. So it's not that the injuries are scaring away the partners now. But as we see, business isn't just about the here and now, what's underneath our nose. It's also what's happening down the road. And I worry that if we don't fix this problem soon, we're going to see fans tune out. Because if that 66% participation from stars goes down to 50%, I think fans are just not going to watch these national TV games like they used to, because they just don't know who's going to show up.
It's a completely reasonable concern to have. It is completely reasonable to me for teams to say, we got it. Like, because we need, when this guy comes back, he needs to be able to guard like six actions on a possession that will stretch out 35 feet away from the rim. He's got to show on a pick and roll, 30 feet away from the rim, because now guys can shoot from there if you go under or if you don't trap him. And then he's got to race back to protect the rim. He's got to close out to the short corner. Or if our scheme calls for it, he's Xing out to the far wing. And like the amount of ground, like the full width of the court, the full length of the half court, now you've got more teams picking up in the backcourt and pressing. You've got more increased emphasis on offensive rebounding and the banging and like going up for to try to generate more possessions. Like, the demands physically on start, stops, east, west, and like full length sprinting, full tilt speed that have to happen here. I can't blame anybody that would say like, well, we've got to err on the side of caution for our guys here. I don't blame a fan being like, well, now I don't want to watch though. Like, if it's a bunch of guys I don't know, and the one guy that I do know is on the bench for an extra week because they want to be 100% sure that he's fine. Like, it creates competing incentives, and it creates a situation where like everybody's kind of right and nobody's that happy. And that's a tough spot to be in. And it's especially when you're talking, when you talk about these national games, when you talk about when you've got the full eyes of the league, like as we approach the Christmas Day showcase, as we approach, you know, we're going to get into the Saturday evening, and once we're past the NFL playoffs and the college football playoffs, we're going to be in like more high profile weekend primetime games. Like, they want to have those guys on the court for those. It's also going to be, at that point, 4 months into an 82-game season for these teams that are expecting to play 100 games into June. And it's a lot to ask to have everybody fresh as a daisy for those when they've just played 5 and 7, like, and they're in four different cities. Like, it's a tough road to hoe. And yeah, for the medical professionals you talk to say, it would not surprise me that there, oh yeah, I do believe that there's a link between schedule and density and the nature of the game and the way these injuries are cropping up. I mean, I don't have a medical degree, but it wouldn't surprise me either. And as many times as the league office will tell you, the data just doesn't suggest it. It strains credulity. But again, a lot smarter people than me are doing a lot of work trying to figure it out. The main thing, as you said, I hope we reach a point of return from it where it recedes from the brink of this kind of disaster. I'm worried that we're not. I'm worried that we're going to ask these guys only for more and more and more, more often at higher paces. And there will be some breakdowns as a result of that.
Dan, the counter argument would be, if you really believe that back-to-backs don't raise the level of risk, injury risk, then just have back-to-backs in the playoffs. Why don't you do that? You know? If you really believe that back-to-backs do not raise the level of injury risk, then just have back-to-backs in the playoffs and be done with it. But we don't do that because we all agree that it's good to have these bodies recover to play at their best abilities. And so to me, that's all the evidence that you need, that the NBA knows that there is a link here, but we want the best basketball to be played in the postseason, so we get rid of back-to-backs in the postseason. The NBA knows, in order to get the best basketball and the healthiest basketball during the NBA Cup, we need to make sure that there's no games on the other side of these NBA Cup games. There's no back-to-backs in the NBA Cup. And voila, I think that's a big reason why you see that, is because they understand, there is an understanding that we shouldn't be putting these guys through back-to-backs, because it's not good for our bodies to be put through back-to-backs. And if we started from scratch in the NBA and we did a neuralizer from Men in Black about the customs and the traditions of the NBA, I'd have a hard time believing that the NBA, Adam Silver, and the medical staffs would say 82 is the right number, right? Like 82, if we start from scratch today, that 82 games with all the back-to-backs, that pre-NBA Cup, we've added two back-to-backs to the schedule before the NBA Cup was implemented. That, I don't think, is the optimal number. Financially, though, is a different consideration, but at some point, the financial trend is going to meet the medical risk, and it's going to hopefully not happen in the near term, but I think the way things are going, this conversation is only going to get louder. So Evan Mobley, one thing before we go, they're saying that's a grade one calf strain. I seem to remember when grade one calf strains were 1 to 2 weeks. And now Evan Mobley is out 2 to 4 weeks with a grade one calf strain. So Austin Reeves out with a mild calf strain for at least a week. So we'll see what happens with them. But hopefully they get back soon and we don't have to keep talking about this. But alas, when Victor Wembanyama is coming off the bench in an NBA Cup final and our friends are like, why is he coming off the bench? Oh, it's because calf strains. And why is Karl-Anthony Towns moaning on the bench and groaning, grimacing and grabbing at his leg? Well, he's coming back from a calf strain and he's dealing with that too. So it's a big story. We're going to keep tracking it here. And hopefully these calf strains, they figure it out soon. And Dan, I'm going to get up from this chair in a minute and make sure I get up properly so I don't suffer my own calf strain. But before we do that, I want to give everyone a shout out behind the scenes, especially Sarah and Ryan for producing the show today. Appreciate y'all for doing that. And I want to make sure everyone goes and follows our Yahoo NBA YouTube page, brand spanking new here coming up. It is its own dedicated Yahoo NBA channel at YouTube that you can find this show and the Dunker Spot and KOC show on YouTube for all of your Yahoo sports needs. And go give us 5-star rating, leave us a comment, and hit that, smash that subscribe button for us. Dan, enjoy your weekend. We'll talk soon, and another big number next week.